Chapter 12. The next day the wind had dropped off, and Roger and the boys were swimming on the beach, and Thomas Hudson was on the upper porch working. Eddie had said he thought it would do David's feet no harm to swim in the salt water if he put a new dressing on them afterwards. So they had all gone in, and Thomas Hudson had looked down and watched them from time to time while he painted. He was wondering about Roger and the girl, and that distracted him, so he stopped thinking about it. He could not help thinking of how much the girl reminded him of young Tom's mother when he had first met her. But so many girls had managed to look in such a way that they reminded him of her, and he went on working. He was sure that he would see this girl in time, and he was quite sure they would see much of her. That had been clear enough. Well, she was decorative, and she seemed very nice. If she reminded him of Tommy's mother, that was too damn bad, but there was nothing to do about it. He had been through that one enough times before. He kept on working. This picture would be good, he knew. The next one, with the fish in the water, was going to be the really difficult one. Maybe I should have tried it first, he thought. No, it's better to get this one done. I can always work on the other one after they're gone. Let me carry you up, Davy, he heard Roger say, so you won't get dry sand in them. All right, David said. Let me get them both clean here in the ocean first. Roger carried him up the beach and onto a chair by the doorway that faced the ocean. As they passed under the porch on the way to the chair, Thomas Hudson heard David ask, "Do you think she'll turn up, Mr. Davis?" "I don't know," Roger said. "I hope so." "Don't you think she's beautiful, Mr. Davis?"
"Lovely."
"She likes us, I think."
"Mr. Davis, what does a girl like that do?"
"I don't know. I didn't ask her."
"Tommy's in love with her. So is Andy."
"Are you?"
"I don't know. I don't get in love with people like they do. Anyway, I want to see her some more."
"Mr. Davis, she isn't a bitch, is she?"
"I don't know. She doesn't look like one. Why?"
"Tommy said he was in love with her, but that she was probably just a bitch. Andy said he didn't care if she was a bitch."
"She doesn't look like one," Roger told him.
"Mr. Davis, aren't those men with her a strange, quiet lot?"
"They certainly are."
"What do men like that do?"
"We'll ask her when she comes."
"Do you think she'll come?"
"Yes," Roger said. "I wouldn't worry if I were you."
"It's Tommy and Andy that are worried. I'm in love with someone else. You know, I told you."
"I remember. This girl looks like her, too," Roger told him.
"Maybe she saw her in the cinema and tried to look like her," David said.
Thomas Hudson went on working.
Roger was dressing David's feet when she came in sight walking up the beach. She was barefooted and wore a bathing suit with a skirt of the same material over it, and she carried a beach bag. Thomas Hudson was glad to see that her legs were as good as her face and as good as her breasts that he had seen under her sweater. Her arms were lovely and all of her was brown. She had no makeup on except for her lips, and she had a lovely mouth that he wanted to see with no lipstick on it.
"Hello," she said. "Am I very late?"
"No," Roger told her. "We've been in, but I'm going in again." Roger had moved David's chair out to the edge of the beach, and Thomas Hudson watched her as she bent over David's feet and saw the small upturning curls at the nape of her neck as the weight of her hair fell forward. The small curls were silvery in the sun against her brown skin.
"What happened to them?" she asked. "The poor feet."
"I wore them off pulling on a fish," David told her.
"How big was he?"
"We don't know. He pulled out."
"I'm awfully sorry."
"That's all right," David said. "Nobody minds about him anymore."
"Is it all right to swim with them?"
Roger was touching the worn places with mercurochrome. They looked good and clean, but the flesh was a little puckered from the salt water.
"Eddie says it's good for them."
"Who is Eddie?"
"He's our cook."
"And is your cook your doctor, too?"
"He knows about things like that," David explained. "Mr. Davis said it was all right, too."
"Does Mr. Davis say anything else?" she asked Roger.
"He's glad to see you."
"That's nice. Did you boys have a wild night?"
"Not very," Roger said. "We had a poker game, and afterwards I read and went to sleep."
"Who won in the poker game?"
"Andy and Eddie," David said. "What did you do?"
"We played backgammon."
"Did you sleep well?" Roger asked.
"Yes. Did you?"
"Wonderfully," he said. Tommy is the only one of us who plays backgammon, David told the girl. It was taught him by a worthless man who turned out to be a fairy.
Really? What a sad story.
The way Tommy tells it, it isn't so sad, David said. There wasn't anything bad happened.
I think fairies are all awfully sad, she said. Poor fairies.
This was sort of funny, though, David said, because this worthless man that taught Tommy backgammon was explaining to Tommy what it meant to be a fairy and all about the Greeks and Damon and Pythias and David and Jonathan, you know, sort of like when they tell you about the fish and the roe and the milt and the bees fertilizing the pollen and all that at school. And Tommy asked him if he'd ever read a book by Gide. What was it called, Mr. Davis? Not Corydon, the other one, with Oscar Wilde in it.
C'est le grand mère, Roger said.
It's a pretty dreadful book that Tommy took to read the boys in school. They couldn't understand it in French, of course, but Tommy used to translate it. Lots of it is awfully dull, but it gets pretty dreadful when Mr. Gide gets to Africa.
I've read it, the girl said.
Oh, fine, David said. Then you know the sort of thing I mean. Well, this man who taught Tommy backgammon and turned out to be a fairy was awfully surprised when Tommy spoke about this book, but he was sort of pleased because now he didn't have to go through all the part about the bees and flowers of that business, and he said, I'm so glad you know, or something like that. And then Tommy said this to him exactly. I memorized it. Mr. Edwards, I take only an academic interest in homosexuality. I thank you very much for teaching me backgammon, and I must bid you good day.
Tommy had wonderful manners then, David told her. He'd just come from living in France with Papa, and he had wonderful manners.
Did you live in France, too?
We all did, at different times, but Tommy's the only one who remembers it properly. Tommy has the best memory anyway. He remembers truly, too.
Did you ever live in France?
For a long time.
Did you go to school there?
Yes, outside of Paris.
Wait till you get with Tommy, David said. He knows Paris and outside of Paris the way I know the reef here or the flats. Probably I don't know them even as well as Tommy knows Paris.
She was sitting down now in the shade of the porch, and she was sifting the white sand through her toes. Tell me about the reef and the flats, she said.
It's better if I show them to you, David said. I'll take you out on a skiff on the flats and we can go goggle fishing if you like it. That's the only way to know the reef.
I'd love to go.
Who's on the yacht? Roger asked.
People. You wouldn't like them.
They seemed very nice.
Do we have to talk that way?
No, Roger said.
You met the man of persistence. He's the richest and the dullest.
Can't we just not talk about them? They're all good and wonderful and dull as hell.
Young Tom came up with Andrew following him. They had been swimming far down the beach, and when they had come out and seen the girl by David's chair, they had come running on the hard sand, and Andrew had been left behind. He came up out of breath.
You could have waited, he said to young Tom.
I'm sorry, Andy, young Tom said. Then he said, good morning. We waited for you, but then we went in.
I'm sorry I'm late.
You're not late. We're all going in again.
I'll stay out, David said. You all go in now. I've been talking too much anyway.
You don't have to worry about undertow, young Tom told her. It's a long, gradual slope.
What about sharks and barracuda?
Sharks only come in at night, Roger told her. Barracuda never bother you. They'd only hit you if the water was roily or muddy.
If they just saw a flash of something and didn't know what it was, they might strike at it by mistake, David explained. But they don't bite people in clear water. There's nearly always barracuda around where we swim.
You can see them float along over the sand right alongside of you, young Tom said. They're very curious, but they always go away.
If you had fish, though, David told her, like goggle fishing and the fish on a stringer or in a bag, they'd go after the fish and they might hit you by accident because they're so fast.
Or if you were swimming in a bunch of mullet or a big school of sardines, young Tom said, they could hit you when they were slashing in after the school fish.
You swim between Tom and me, Andy said. Nothing will bother you that way.
The waves were breaking heavily on the beach, and the sandpipers and Wilson plover ran twinklingly out onto the hard, new wet sand as the water receded before the next wave broke.
Do you think we ought to swim when it's this rough and we can't see?
Oh, sure, David told her. Just watch where you walk before you start to swim. It's probably too rough for a stingray to lie in the sand anyway. Mr. Davis and I will look after you, young Tom said.
I'll look after you, Andy said.
If you bump into any fish in the surf, they're probably little pompanos, David said. They come in on the high tide to feed on the sand fleas. They're awfully pretty in the water, and they're curious and friendly.
It sounds a little like swimming in an aquarium, she said.
Andy will teach you how to let the air out of your lungs to stay down deep, David told her. Tom will show you how not to get in trouble with morays.
Don't try to scare her, Dave, young Tom said. We're not big kings of underwater like he is. But just because he's a king of underwater, Miss Bruce.
Audrey.
Audrey, Tom said, and stopped.
What were you saying, Tommy?
I don't know, young Tom said. Let's go in and swim. Thomas Hudson worked on for a while. Then he went down and sat by David and watched the four of them in the surf. The girl was swimming without a cap, and she swam and dove as sleek as a seal. She was as good a swimmer as Roger, except for the difference in power. When they came in onto the beach and came walking toward the house in the hard sand, the girl's hair was wet and went straight back from her forehead, so there was nothing to trick the shape of her head, and Thomas Hudson thought he had never seen a lovelier face nor a finer body. Except one, he thought. Except the one finest and loveliest. Don't think about it, he told himself. Just look at this girl and be glad she's here. How was it? He asked her.
Wonderful, she smiled at him. But I didn't see any fish at all, she told David.
You probably wouldn't in so much surf, David said, unless you bumped into them. She was sitting on the sand with her hands clasped around her knees. Her hair hung damp to her shoulders, and the two boys sat beside her. Roger lay on the sand in front of her with his forehead on his folded arms. Thomas Hudson opened the screen door and went inside the house and then upstairs to the porch to work on the picture. He thought that that was the best thing for him to do. Below on the sand, where Thomas Hudson no longer watched them, the girl was looking at Roger.
Are you gloomy? She asked him.
No.
Thoughtful?
A little, maybe, I don't know.
On a day like this, it's nice not to think at all.
All right, let's not think. Is it all right if I watch the waves?
The waves are free.
Do you want to go in again?
Later.
Who taught you to swim? Roger asked her.
You did.
Roger raised his head and looked at her.
Don't you remember the beach at Cap d'Antibes?
The little beach, not Eden Rock.
I used to watch you dive at Eden Rock.
What the hell are you doing here, and what is your real name?
I came to see you, she said. And I suppose my name is Audrey Bruce.
Should we go, Mr. Davis?
Young Tom asked. Roger did not even answer him.
What's your real name?
I was Audrey Rayburn.
And why did you come to see me?
Because I wanted to. Was it wrong?
I guess not, Roger said.
Who said I was here?
A dreadful man I met at a cocktail party in New York. You'd had a fight with him here. He said you were a beachcomber.
Well, it's combed pretty neatly, Roger said, looking out to sea.
He said you were quite a few other things, too. None of them were very complimentary.
Who were you at Antibes with?
With Mother and Dick Rayburn.
Now do you remember?
Roger sat up and looked at her.
Then he went over and put his arms around her and kissed her.
I'll be damned, he said.
Was it all right to come? She asked.
You old brat, Roger said. Is it really you?
Do I have to prove it? Couldn't you just believe it?
I don't remember any secret marks.
Do you like me now?
I'll love you now. You couldn't expect me to look like a colt forever.
Do you remember when you told me I looked like a colt at Otoy that time and I cried?
It was a compliment, too. I said you looked like a colt out of Alice in Wonderland.
I cried.
Mr. Davis, Andy said, and Audrey,
We boys are going to go and get some Cokes. Do you want any?
No, Andy. You, Brat?
Yes, I'd love one.
Come on, Dave.
No, I want to hear it.
You are a bastard for a brother sometimes, young Tom said. Bring me one, too, David said. Go right ahead, Mr. Davis. Don't mind me at all.
I don't mind you, Davy, the girl said.
But where did you go and why are you Audrey Bruce?
It's sort of complicated.
I guess it was.
Mother married a man named Bruce, finally.
I knew him.
I liked him.
I pass, Roger said, but why the Audrey?
It's my middle name. I took it because I didn't like mother's.
I didn't like mother.
Neither did I. I liked Dick Rayburn, and I liked Bill Bruce, and I loved you, and I loved Tom Hudson. He didn't recognize me either, did he?
I don't know. He's strange, and he might not say. I know he thinks you look like Tommy's mother.
I wish I did.
You do damn plenty enough.
Truly, you do, David said. That's something I know about. I'm sorry, Audrey. I ought to shut up and go away.
You didn't love me, and you didn't love Tom.
Oh, yes, I did. You'll never know.
Where's mother now?
She's married to a man named Jeffrey Townsend and lives in London.
Does she still drug?
Of course, and she's beautiful.
Really?
No, really, she is. This isn't just filial piety.
You had a lot of filial piety once.
I know. I used to pray for everyone. Everything used to break my heart. I used to do First Fridays for Mother to give her the grace of a happy death.
You don't know how I prayed for you, Roger.
I wish it would have done more good, Roger said.
So do I, she said.
You can't tell, Audrey. You never know when it may, David said. I don't mean that Mr. Davis needs to be prayed for. I just mean about prayer, technically.
Thanks, Dave, Roger said.
Whatever became of Bruce?
He died, don't you remember?
No, I remember Dick Rayburn did.
I imagine you do.
I do.
Young Tom and Andy came back with the bottles of Coca-Cola, and Andy gave a cold bottle to the girl and one to David.
Thank you, she said. It's wonderful and cold.
Audrey, young Tom said, I remember you now. You used to come to the studio with Mr. Rayburn. You never talked at all. You and I and Papa and Mr. Rayburn used to go to the different circuses, and we used to go racing.
But you weren't as beautiful then.
Sure she was, Roger said. Ask your father.
I'm sorry about Mr. Rayburn dying, young Tom said. I remember him dying very well. He was killed by a bobsled that rode high over a turn and went into the crowd. He'd been very ill, and Papa and I went to visit him. Then he was better after a while, and he went to watch the bob races, although he shouldn't have. We weren't there when he was killed. I'm sorry if talking about it upsets you, Audrey.
He was a nice man, Audrey said. It doesn't upset me, Tommy. It was a long time ago.
Did you know either of us boys?
Andy asked her.
How could she, horseman? We weren't born yet, David said.
How was I to know? Andy asked. I can't remember anything about France, and I don't think you remember much.
I don't pretend to. Tommy remembers France for all of us. Later on, I'll remember this island, and I can remember every picture Papa ever painted that I've seen.
Can you remember the racing ones? Audrey asked.
Every one I've seen.
I was in some of them, Audrey said, at Longchamp and at Auteuil and at Saint-Cloud. It's always the back of my head.
I can remember the back of your head then, young Tom said.
And your hair was down to your waist, and I was two steps above you to see better. It was a hazy day, the way it is in the fall when it's blue, smoky-looking, and we were in the upper stand right opposite the water jump, and on our left was the bullfinch and the stone wall. The finish was on the side closer to us, and the water jump was on the inner course of the track. I was always above and behind you to see better, except when we were down at the track.
I thought you were a funny little boy then.
I guess I was, and you never talked. Maybe because I was so young, but wasn't Auteuil a beautiful track, though?
Wonderful. I was there last year.
Maybe we can go this year, Tommy, David said. Did you used to go to the races with her too, Mr. Davis?
No, Roger said. I was just her swimming teacher.
You were my hero.
Wasn't Papa ever your hero? Andrew asked.
Of course he was. But I couldn't let him be my hero as much as I wanted because he was married. When he and Tommy's mother were divorced, I wrote him a letter. It was very powerful, and I was ready to take Tommy's mother's place in any way I could. But I never sent it because he married Davy's and Andy's mother.
Things are certainly complicated, young Tom said. Tell us some more about Paris, David said. We ought to learn all we can if we're going there now.
Do you remember when we'd be down on the rail, Audrey? And how after the horses came over the last obstacle, they would be coming straight down toward us, and the way they would look coming bigger and bigger, and the noise they would make on the turf when they would go past?
And how cold it used to be, and how we would get close to the big braziers to get warm and eat the sandwiches from the bar?
I loved it in the fall, young Tom said. We used to ride back home in a carriage, an open one, do you remember? Out of the bois and then along the river with it just getting dark and the burning leaves smell and the tugs towing barges on the river.
Do you really remember it that well? You were an awfully small boy.
I remember every bridge on the river from Suresnes to Charenton, Tommy told her.
You can't.
I can't name them, but I've got them in my head.
I don't believe you can remember them all. And part of the river's ugly, and many of the bridges are.
I know it, but I was there a long time after I knew you, and Papa and I used to walk the whole river, the ugly parts and the beautiful parts, and I've fished a lot of it with different friends of mine.
Up on the porch, Thomas Hudson kept on painting. He could not keep from hearing their talk, but he had not looked down at them since they had come in from swimming. He was having a difficult time staying in the carapace of work that he had built for his protection, and he thought, if I don't work now, I may lose it. Then he thought that there would be time to work when they were all gone, but he knew he must keep on working now, or he would lose the security he had built for himself with work. I will do exactly as much as I would have done if they were not here, he thought. Then I will clear up and go down, and the hell with thinking of Rayburn, or of the old days, or of anything. But as he worked, he felt a loneliness coming into him already. It was next week when they would leave. Work, he told himself. Get it right and keep your habits because you are going to need them. When he had finished work and gone down to join them, Thomas Hudson was still thinking about the painting, and he said hi to the girl and then looked away from her. Then he looked back.
I couldn't help hearing it, he said, or overhearing it. I'm glad we're old friends.
So am I. Did you know?
Maybe, he said. Let's get lunch. Are you dry, Audrey?
I'll change in the shower, she said. I have a shirt and a skirt to this.
Tell Joseph and Eddie that we're ready, Thomas Hudson said to young Tom. I'll show you the shower, Audrey.
Roger went into the house.
I thought I shouldn't be here under false pretenses, Audrey said.
You weren't.
Don't you think I could be any good for him?
You might. What he needs is to work well to save his soul. I don't know anything about souls. But he misplaced his the first time he went out to the coast.
But he's going to write a novel now, a great novel.
Where did you hear that?
It was in one of the columns, Charlie Knickerbocker, I think.
Oh, Thomas Hudson said, then it must be true.
Don't you truly think I might be good for him?
You might.
There are some complications.
There always are.
Should I tell you now?
No, Thomas Hudson said. You better get dressed and comb your hair and get up there. He might meet some other woman while he was waiting.
You weren't like this in the old days. I thought you were the kindest man I ever knew.
I'm awfully sorry, Audrey, and I'm glad you're here.
We are old friends, aren't we?
Sure, he said. Change and fix yourself up and get up there. He looked away from the girl and she shut the door of the shower. He did not know what made him feel as he did, but the happiness of the summer began to drain out of him as when the tide changes on the flats and the ebb begins in the channel that opens out to sea. He watched the sea and the line of beach, and he noticed that the tide had changed and the shore birds were working busily well down the slope of the new wet sand. The breakers were diminishing as they receded. He looked a long way up along the shore and then went into the house.
Chapter 13. They had a fine time the last few days. It was as good as any of the time before, and there was no pre-going sadness. The yacht left, and Audrey took a room over the Ponce de Leon, but she stayed at the house and slept on a cot on the sleeping porch at the far end of the house and used the guest room. She did not say anything again about being in love with Roger. All Roger said to Thomas Hudson about her was, "She's married to some sort of a son of a bitch. You couldn't expect her to wait all her life for you, could you? At least he's a son of a bitch. Aren't they always? You'll find he has his nice side. He's rich." "That's probably his nice side," Thomas Hudson said. "They're always married to some son of a bitch, and he always has some tremendously nice side." "All right," Roger said, "let's not talk about it. You're going to do the book, aren't you?" "Sure, that's what she wants me to do." "Is that why you're going to do it?" "Shove it, Tom," Roger told him. "Do you want to use the Cuba house? It's only a shack, but you'd be away from people." "No, I want to go west."
"The coast?"
"No, not the coast. Could I stay at the ranch for a while?"
"There's only the one cabin that's on the far beach. I rented the rest."
"That would be fine."
The girl and Roger took long walks on the beach and swam together and with the boys. The boys went bone fishing and took Audrey bone fishing and goggle fishing on the reef. Thomas Hudson worked hard, and all the time he was working and the boys were out on the flats, he had the good feeling that they would be home soon and they would be having supper or dinner together. He was worried when they were goggle fishing, but he knew Roger and Eddie would make them be careful. One time they all went trolling for a full day up to the furthest light at the end of the bank and had a wonderful day with bonito and dolphin and three big wahoo. He painted a canvas of wahoo with his strange flattened head and his stripes around his long speed-built body for Andy, who had caught the biggest one. He painted him against a background of the big spider-legged lighthouse with the summer clouds and the green of the banks. Then, one day, the old Sikorsky amphibian circled the house once and then landed in the bay, and they rowed the three boys out to her in the dinghy. Joseph sculled out in another dinghy with their bags. Young Tom said, "Goodbye, Papa. It certainly was a swell summer." David said, "Goodbye, Papa. It certainly was wonderful. Don't worry about anything. We'll be careful." Andrew said, "Goodbye, Papa. Thanks for a wonderful, wonderful summer and for the trip to Paris." They climbed up into the cockpit door and all waved from the door to Audrey, who was standing on the dock, and called, "Goodbye, goodbye, Audrey." Roger was helping them up, and they said, "Goodbye, Mr. Davis. Goodbye, Papa." Then very loud and carrying over the water, "Goodbye, Audrey." Then the door closed and locked, and they were faces through the small glass panes, and then they were water-splashed faces as the old coffee mills revved up. Thomas Hudson pulled away from the rush of spray, and the ancient, ugly plane taxied out and took off into the little breeze there was, and then circled once and straightened course, steady, ugly, and slow across the Gulf. Thomas Hudson knew Roger and Audrey would be leaving, and as the runboat was coming the next day, he asked Roger when he was going.
"Tomorrow, old Tom," Roger said.
"With Wilson?"
"Yes, I asked him to come back. I just wanted to know about ordering on the runboat."
So the next day they left the same way. Thomas Hudson kissed the girl goodbye and she kissed him. She had cried when the boys left, and she cried that day and held him close and hard. "Take good care of him and take good care of you."
"I'm going to try. You've been awful good to us, Tom."
"Nonsense." "All right," Roger said. "Is there anything you want me to do out there?"
"Have fun."
"You might let me know how things are."
"I will. This one will write, too."
So they were gone, too, and Thomas Hudson stopped in at Bobby's on the way home.
"Gonna be goddamn lonely," Bobby said.
"Yes," Thomas Hudson said.
"It's going to be goddamn lonely."
Chapter 14. Thomas Hudson was unhappy as soon as the boys were gone, but he thought that was normal lonesomeness for them, and he just kept on working. The end of a man's own world does not come as it does in one of the great paintings Mr. Bobby had outlined.
It comes with one of the island boys bringing a radio message up the road from the local post office and saying,
"Please sign on the detachable part of the envelope. We're sorry, Mr. Tom."
He gave the boy a shilling, but the boy looked at it and put it down on the table.
"I don't care for a tip, Mr. Tom," the boy said and went out.
He read it. Then he put it in his pocket and went out the door and sat on the porch by the sea. He took the radio form out and read it again. "Your sons, David and Andrew, killed with their mother in motor accident near Biarritz, attending to everything, pending your arrival, deepest sympathy." It was signed by the Paris branch of his New York bank. Eddie came out. He had heard about it from Joseph, who had heard about it from one of the boys at the radio shack. Eddie sat down by him and said,
"Shit, Tom. How can such things happen?"
"I don't know," said Thomas Hudson. "I guess they hit something or something ran into them."
"I'll bet Davy wasn't driving," Eddie said.
"I'll bet so too, but it doesn't matter anymore." Thomas Hudson looked out at the flatness of the blue sea and the darker blue of the Gulf. The sun was low, and soon it would be behind the clouds.
"You think their mother was driving?"
"Probably. Maybe they had a chauffeur. What difference does it make?"
"Do you think it could have been Andy?"
"Could be. His mother might let him."
"He's conceited enough," Eddie said.
"He was," said Thomas Hudson. "I don't think he's conceited now." The sun was going down and there were clouds in front of it. "We'll get a wire to Wilkinson on their next radio schedule to come over early and for him to call up and save me space on a plane to New York."
"What do you want me to do while you're away?"
"Just look after things. I'll leave you some checks for each month. If there are any blows, get plenty of good help with the boat and the house."
"I'll do everything," Eddie said, "but I don't give a shit about anything anymore."
"I don't either," said Thomas Hudson.
"We've got young Tom."
"For the time being," Thomas Hudson said, and for the first time he looked straight down the long and perfect perspective of the blankness ahead.
"You'll make it all right," Eddie said.
"Sure. When didn't I ever make it?"
"You can stay in Paris a while and then go to the Cuba House and young Tom can keep you company. You can paint good over there and it'll be like a change."
"Sure," said Thomas Hudson.
"You can travel and that'll be good. Go on those big boats like I always wanted to go on. Travel on all of them. Let them take you anywhere they go."
"Sure."
"Shit," said Eddie. "What the fuck they killed that Davy for?"
"Let's leave it alone, Eddie," Thomas Hudson said. "It's way past things we know about."
"Fuck everything,"
Eddie said, and pushed his hat back on his head. "We'll play it out the way we can," Thomas Hudson told him. But now he knew he did not have much interest in the game. Chapter 15. On the eastward crossing on the Ile de France, Thomas Hudson learned that hell was not necessarily as it was described by Dante or any of the other great hell describers, but could be a comfortable, pleasant, and well-loved ship taking you toward a country that you had always sailed for with anticipation. It had many circles, and they were not fixed as in those of the great Florentine egotist. He had gone aboard the ship early, thinking of it, he now knew, as a refuge from the city where he had feared meeting people who would speak to him about what had happened. He thought that on the ship he could come to some terms with his sorrow, not knowing yet that there are no terms to be made with sorrow. It can be cured by death, and it can be blunted or anesthetized by various things. Time is supposed to cure it, too. But if it is cured by anything less than death, the chances are that it was not true sorrow. One of the things that blunts it temporarily through blunting everything else is drinking, and another thing that can keep the mind away from it is work. Thomas Hudson knew about both these remedies. But he also knew that drinking would destroy the capacity for producing satisfying work, and he had built his life on work for so long now that he kept it as the one thing that he must not lose. But since he knew he could not work now for some time, he planned to drink, and read and exercise until he was tired enough to sleep. He had slept on the plane, but he had not slept in New York. Now he was in his stateroom, which had a sitting room connected with it, and the porters had left his bags and the big package of magazines and newspapers he had bought. He had thought they would be the easiest thing to start with. He gave his ticket to the room steward and asked him for a bottle of Perrier water and some ice. When they came, he took out a fifth of good scotch from one of his bags and opened it and made himself a drink. Then he cut the string around the big bundle of magazines and papers and spread them on the table. The magazines looked fresh and virginal compared with the way they looked when they arrived at the island. He took up the New Yorker. At the island, he had always saved it for the evenings, and it had been a long time since he had seen a New Yorker of the week of publication, or one that had not been folded. He sat in the deep, comfortable chair and drank his drink, and learned that you cannot read the New Yorker when people that you love have just died. He tried Time, and he could read it all right, including Milestones, where the two boys were dead, complete with their ages, their mother's age, not quite accurate, her marital status, and the statement that she had divorced him in 1933. Newsweek had the same facts. But reading the short item, Thomas Hudson had the odd sensation that the man who wrote it was sorry that the boys were dead. He made himself another drink and thought how much better the Perrier was than anything else you could put in whiskey, and then he read both Time and Newsweek through. What the hell do you suppose she was doing at Biarritz, he thought. At least she could have gone to Saint-Jean-de-Luz. From that, he knew the whiskey was doing some good. Give them up now, he told himself. Just remember how they were and write them off. You have to do it sooner or later. Do it now. Read some more, he said. Just then the ship started to move. It was moving very slowly, and he did not look out of the window of the sitting room. He sat in the comfortable chair and read through the pile of papers and magazines and drank the scotch and Perrier. You haven't any problem at all, he told himself. You've given them up, and they're gone. You should not have loved them so damn much in the first place. You shouldn't have loved them, and you shouldn't have loved their mother. Listen to the whiskey talking, he said to himself. What a solvent of our problems. The solvent alchemist that in a trice our leaden gold into shit transmutes. That doesn't even scan. Our leaden gold to shit transmutes is better. I wonder where Roger is with that girl, he thought. The bank will know where Tommy is. I know where I am. I'm in here with a bottle of old par. Tomorrow I'll sweat this all out in the gym. I'll use the heat box. I'll ride on one of those bicycles that goes nowhere and on a mechanical horse. That's what I need. A good ride on a mechanical horse. Then I'll get a good rubdown. Then I'll meet somebody in the bar and I'll talk about other things. It's only 6 days. 6 days is easy. He went to sleep that night, and when he woke in the night, he heard the movement of the ship through the sea, and at first, smelling the sea, he thought that he was at home in the house on the island and that he had wakened from a bad dream. Then he knew it was not a bad dream, and he smelled the heavy grease on the edges of the open window. He switched the light on and drank some of the Perrier water. He was very thirsty. There was a tray with some sandwiches and fruit on the table where the steward had left them the night before, and there was still ice in the bucket that held the Perrier. He knew he should eat something, and he looked at the clock on the wall. It was 3:20 in the morning. The sea air was cool, and he ate a sandwich and two apples and then took some ice out of the bucket and made himself a drink. The old par was about gone, but he had another bottle, and now, in the cool of the early morning, he sat in the comfortable chair and drank and read the New Yorker. He found that he could read it now, and he found that he enjoyed drinking in the night. For years, he had kept an absolute rule about not drinking in the night and never drinking before he had done his work except on non-working days. But now, as he woke in the night, he felt the simple happiness of breaking training. It was the first return of any purely animal happiness or capacity for happiness that he had experienced since the cable had come. The New Yorker was very good, he thought, and it's evidently a magazine you can read on the fourth day after something happens. Not on the first or the second or the third, but on the fourth. That was useful to know. After the New Yorker, he read The Ring, and then he read everything that was readable in the Atlantic Monthly, and some that was not. Then he made his third drink and read Harper's. You see, he said to himself, there's nothing to it.
This ends Disc 5.